Good afternoon. This is Nevin Campanella welcoming you to the BBS production of Woodland Star, your net radio source for entertainment and coincidental enlightenment. Today's guest is Veronica Monet. Veronica is the founding member of the Association of Sexual Energy Professionals and a trained volunteer for the Center Against Rape and Domestic Violence. She specializes in sexuality, anger management, nonviolent communication, and relationship dynamics. If you'd like to call into our show to ask Veronica questions, the toll-free numbers are, for USA and Canada, 888-228-4494. And worldwide, this number always amazes me, folks, 877-489-6350. Folks, I gave the introduction on Veronica, but I got to tell you, she's a lot more than that little sentence I gave. She's an extremely, extremely involved individual, involved in life. Let's get her on board. Veronica, are you there?
I'm here.
Wonderful. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. I just took the dogs on a big post-Thanksgiving hike, and I live up here in the Tahoe National Forest now. I recently moved up about 3 years ago. So it's a pretty remote area. Got bears and cougars and all kinds of things.
Oh, well, it sounds like you're having a good time. My wife and I used to live in Alma, New Mexico, and we lived extremely isolated with all the animals you were talking about. Yeah, we spent about 8 years up in the Gila National Forest. And so for us, when we got up in the morning, all we ever heard was the whisper of the breeze through the trees, and that was about it, and a few birds. But since then, we, because of medical reasons, we've had to move to a much more populated area. Well, Veronica, there is so much about you. An interviewer such as myself hardly knows where to begin. And, I mean, to say the least, you've had an extremely fascinating life. And, folks, her life has been in that very area that many of us have had difficulty talking about. And Veronica is going to help us with that a little bit today. Now, Veronica, before we get started... Okay, before we get started into the issue of sexology, I'd like for you to describe a little bit about your background. Go all the way back. You know, what was your childhood like? Where did you grow up? So on and so forth.
I grew up in the state of Oregon, and my parents were blue-collar. So my dad was a welder, my mom was a homemaker. And we were a Christian family, very, very right-wing, fundamental Christians. So I read the Bible from cover to cover by the time I was 12. And, you know, used to attend church very devoutly. And one of the overarching messages that I got about sex was that it was okay if you were married, but very, very, very sinful if you weren't. And in fact, there were certain types of sexuality that were absolutely forbidden, no matter whether you were married or not. So I would say that I was inculcated with a great deal of sexual shame as a child.
Well, your background probably isn't very different than the majority of people, at least a generation or two back for sure. Would you describe, given what I just said, would you describe, I'm fishing here. Would you describe your childhood as fairly normal?
No.
Why not?
I wouldn't say my child was normal at all, actually, because I was kept out of the public school system because my parents felt that sex education was a communist plot to throw over the government. So we stayed out of public school until I got into college. So the first 16, well, not first. First 12 years of my education took place at home with correspondence courses. And, well, and then I went to Oregon State University. But when I got to Oregon State University, it was such a culture shock because I had never had any friends, or no peer group. I knew so little. I almost felt like I was from a foreign country coming to the United States for the first time.
So when you left home, for you it was a literally an explosion away from the past.
Oh, it was like going to a new country. It really was. There was so much to learn about the culture. Now, the advantage that this has given me is an ability to see myself outside of the dominant culture because I've never really identified with it in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
So, although I was able to very quickly assimilate, and a lot of people never were the least suspicious that I had the roots that I had, because I learned to be something of a chameleon. But the bottom line is that I never felt horribly constricted or controlled by the dominant culture, and it's really made it possible for me to lead a life that was uncommon. Whereas most people would have felt like, oh, I don't want certain people to disapprove of me, and I don't want to lose my membership here or lose my membership there. I didn't have those kind of forces, bearing down on me. So I took very, very big chances with my life and did some really unusual things that a lot of people would be shocked. You know, it was like I went to college for 4 years, and then I worked in corporate America for 7 years after that before I ever got into the sex industry. That's a pretty
unusual. What did you do in corporate America?
Welcome to the show, The Metaphysical World and More.
I worked.
My name is Nancy, and I host the show.
For a computer company.
And today I have another
guest.
Hold on, Veronica. Hold on. We're getting interference here.
Show.
I hear that.
Thank you, Nancy.
Now, Lynn, let's talk a little bit about who you are and what you do.
We have. We're going at cross purposes here.
Yeah, it sounds like we're on the show.
And I own my own business.
Hold on a minute, Veronica. Let me get another phone here. I
got to
get back to the station manager.
27 years.
Already?
Hold on for 1 minute.
I trained within an Alexandrian coven many, many years ago. And it's been all, I've never looked back since then.
It's kind of funny because I'm sure if somebody just tuned in, they heard, and I'm
aware. Yeah, we're having
So, you say that you've been trained many, many years ago.
This is very strange.
Has this ever happened before, Nevin?
No, you know what happened.
The training I've been through actually covers many areas. It not only covers history.
This is a new system that the production company has been involved in. I don't think they got things quite straight yet.
It would seem that they do. But hi, Nancy, and whoever that other person is.
Hey, folks, listen, we're working at cross purposes here. I'm going to give Don a call. I don't know how we all went. Okay, thank you, Don. Don's got it straight. Veronica, are you still there?
I'm still here, Nevin.
Okay. Geez, Veronica, I'm really sorry about that. Live radio, you never know what's going to happen. All right, let's get back to your college career. There are a couple of questions I have about it. What did you major in?
I got a Bachelor of Science in Psychology with a minor in Business Administration, and I took all of the requireds for a sociology degree, but I didn't actually declare a double major. So psychology, sociology, and business administration are my topics.
And what made you your first job? You mentioned corporate America. What was your first job?
Office manager for a furniture store in San Jose. Then after that, I was a dispatcher for a telecommunications firm in Santa Clara. And then after that, I was a secretary for a computer company. And then after that, I was a marketing representative for a radio station, ironically enough. I used to work for KLRS in Santa Cruz.
Okay, now at some point, you make a jump out of corporate America. After seven years of... What did you do?
Well, here was what was going on for me. This is from 1982 to 1989. I was really, really frustrated with feeling like I just, no matter what I did, I couldn't get ahead. So I took a lot of training. I worked a lot of extra hours. I was always volunteering for stuff. A very, very ambitious person, but I didn't play the office politic game very well. And so one particular instance that really, really pissed me off was they fired my boss one time and put me in charge of his phones and dispatching his technicians, and all of a sudden I was talking to company presidents, and I was doing everything except signing paychecks. And while I was in charge, department revenue went up $10,000 in 1 month, which back in 1982 was a sizable amount of money. And my reward was that they brought in another man to be my supervisor, and I got to train him how to do his job.
Oh, that's sad. That is sad. And probably there are a number of women who could relate the same story. Go ahead, Veronica.
I would imagine. So, you know, I was getting pretty upset about this stuff. And the only time I ever did get promoted up through the ranks, a woman was the one who promoted me. So I was seeing a lot of gender bias.
What was the name of this company?
Well, you know, I've...
Don't be afraid to announce it on the air. Go for it.
Yeah, you're not worried about the libel lawsuit.
You're not going to get a lawsuit. Just tell it as... You know what, Veronica, what I found in my 64 years of life is as long as you're telling the truth, you are okay.
That's okay, Nevin. I've learned in my 47 years of life that sometimes telling the story is better than naming names.
All right, go ahead. I won't hold your feet to the fire.
As a escort, that's been of talent for keeping people's secrets has been a real lifesaver for me, and it's something you build your career around. So anyway, what happened? How did I go from working for a radio station to being an escort? I had a coming out experience. I don't know if your listeners are familiar with that. This is when somebody who's not heterosexual but doesn't know that they're not heterosexual finally comes to terms with it, and a coming out experience is pretty life-shaking and life-altering. I mean, you have to go kind of through a grieving process about how you're never going to be quote-unquote normal, and that's what I went through, and I became a bisexual writer and activist. I started working for an organization called the Bay Area Bisexual Network, and I started writing for a magazine called Anything That Moves, which was the first national bisexual magazine. And while I was following these politics, I ended up falling in love with this woman who happened to be a prostitute. And she was also married, and she was older than me, and she had three kids and a husband. And she just defied so many of my stereotypes, I was utterly fascinated. And after about 9 months of dating her, I ended up asking her if I could come work for her.
Okay, wait a minute. That's a big jump. That's a big jump.
I know.
What? You have to have some warm-up to that, you know, all of a sudden going from working to becoming a prostitute. Give me more.
Well, okay, keep in mind I'm really, really pissed off and frustrated at the work front because I've put 7 whole years in and these people are not giving me the raises and the promotions that I think I deserve, and I'm still living off of in 7 years I hadn't really watched my income change that much, and I was barely paying bills. I'd gotten into debt with some credit cards, so my frustration level is building and building and building. Then I meet this woman, and she ends up defying every stereotype. So when I was a volunteer for the Center Against Rape and Domestic Violence in Corvallis, Oregon, everything I knew about prostitutes was that they were all incest survivors or rape survivors who had not gotten therapy for their problems. And when I met this woman, I expected she'd be addicted to drugs, have low self-esteem, and she didn't, and she wasn't. And it really blew my mind. And, of course, you wait around and wait around to find out what's wrong with this picture, what's wrong with this picture. And after about a year, I realized there was nothing wrong with this picture except that people have prejudices. So she was healthy. She was happy. She was, if she was addicted to anything, it was working out at the gym. She was kind of a health nut. And she had a good relationship with her husband and her kids. She was living in a great house and driving a really nice Mercedes. I started looking at her life, looking at my life, and going, hey, wait a minute, who's oppressed?
Uh-huh. Okay, it makes sense. It makes sense, Veronica. That's understandable.
Yeah.
Okay, so what happens? You ask her to get involved. What occurred at that point?
Here's what's really interesting. You got to keep in mind now, I'm an honor student from Oregon State University, right? I worked my way through college as an English tutor, and here I am with my degree and everything, asking this prostitute to teach me how to be a prostitute. And that I really always like to point that out to people, because you would think, and a lot of people think, that this is a really dumb job that anybody can do. But it's true, I suppose, if you don't want to do it right. But this woman was making an amazing amount of money and running it like a small business. So there was a lot to learn from her. And I
was doing this on her own, or was she work for an organization? What did she have a pimp, et cetera, et cetera?
No. Just a small businesswoman working for herself and by herself. Nobody worked for her, and she didn't work for anybody. She had a husband who had a job at IBM, and she had three kids.
I assume that her husband was well aware of her job.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they were swingers. You know, they used to like to go to lifestyle parties, and they were making some pornos, some amateur pornos. So this really fit into their lifestyle. It worked very well for their lifestyle.
So this lady gives you training to become a prostitute.
Yes.
How did it, was there ever a time during this training when you had doubts which would have come up from your childhood background?
God.
I mean,
describe
the feelings.
I ran home the first day after I saw my first client. I ran home and I took a long shower and thought, I must be losing my mind. This is not what people with college diplomas do. And I started thinking, oh, maybe I'm going to go to hell, and you know, my mother's going to be so ashamed of me. And yeah, a lot of shame and guilt and fear came up. It did. But I wasn't convinced. I just stopped. You know, it was like after I took that shower, I thought, you know what? This is all old training, and I'm not buying into this. I like this woman. Seems happy. I have fun around her. I'm enjoying myself. And about 6 months into this new job, I woke up one morning and I heard somebody whistling a tune, and it was me. And I never woke.
You found yourself happy.
Yeah, I never, ever, ever woke up on a work day whistling a tune. So
I'm not sure many people do.
Yeah.
Looking forward to life, that's what that would suggest.
I was. I absolutely was. I liked the money. I liked the variety. I liked the excitement. I liked even the people. At first, you know, I kind of pulled in some boring guys, but after a while I learned that you could pretty much decide what kind of people you wanted to see, and so I started just seeing really interesting, fascinating people. And I mean, we're talking people who are, like, you know, trying to solve world peace or invent cures for cancer. Some amazing, amazing people that I got to spend time with, and I was like, yeah, why wouldn't I be whistling?
How did you get your contacts to begin with? I mean, how did that occur?
God, I don't know, Nevin. You know, sometimes you got to wonder how much of life is, you know, by grand design. Like, I lead a pretty spiritually centered life, and there's a part of me that just feels like it was just part of my fate. It was part of my path. It was just going to happen. But, I mean, because it was really interesting. I had this little background in the media, you know, because I had done radio and television, but just never, ever gotten paid for it. It was just something I was doing as a hobby while I was working as a secretary. And then I hung it up because it wasn't paying the bills. And the next thing I knew, escorting fed right back into the media. I became a spokesperson for Coyote in San Francisco, started doing all of these TV shows, I wound up on CNN 3 times, wound up on the Playboy Channel 3 times, wound up on Bill Maher's Politically Incorrect. And the more television I did, and then I was in the New York Times Magazine, you don't really have to worry about making that phone ring. It rings all on its own. So people would find me through that, and they'd go, oh, I saw you on TV, and I'd really like to go out with you. So it was kind of a fairy tale, if you want to know the truth.
Well, you know, I'm not... it's not unknown to me about making career changes, and while some people may, you know, argue with the kind of change you made, in my own personal life, believe me, it's not comparable to what you went through, but I also made a rather startling career change back in 1994. I have a complete background in psychology, PhD, worked in mental health centers, had private practice, the whole nine yards.
Yeah,
and,
I put some of your bio. It was very fascinating.
Well, I was very disenchanted. I got tired of the formality. I got tired of the bullshit. It was one political situation after another. And so I finally, you know, said, the hell with it. Goodbye. I just turned around and walked away. And now a lot of people, especially my family, and this is going to be the next question to you, by the way. My family really reacted strongly, you know, my extended family. When I said, I'm going to retire out, I had no money. I really did. I didn't have any much money to begin with, but I said, what the hell, I'm going to retire out. And I found my way through what I wanted to do. My second wife, Jill, who's my current wife, she was a student of mine in one of my classes, and I had just been through a divorce and so on and so forth, and I said, come on, let's go run away. And that's what we did. And from that a rather dramatic change, I developed all different kinds of interests and so on and so forth. So I am aware of the change that you went through. Now, what I want to tell you is that on the road through change, I also met many, many other professional people who were doing the same thing I was. I couldn't believe the number of, for instance, attorneys who I would find in the woods strumming a guitar. I mean, it was absolutely amazing what's going on out there. People who are saying they've had enough. Now,
I'm finding a lot of that up here in the Nevada City area, too.
Well, I think the lifestyle in today in the United States, there is such a horrendous, stressful situation for people to perform by someone else's standards that I think some of us are starting to catch on. Now, the question for you.
Yes.
You go through all these changes. Where are you with your family at this point in time when you start making these changes? I mean, were they aware? Did they know what was going on?
Yeah,
they were aware.
Good. Yeah, it's not good. You know, you pay a high price, and that's I could tell you that I got the pretty woman thing going on, but there's also the not pretty side. So my mother, my mom cried for an entire year. Every time I would get on the phone with her, every time we would talk, she'd start crying. So that was hard to deal with. And,
are your parents both alive today?
They're both alive. My dad and mom are divorced. My mom's remarried. And you know, she worries about the people at church finding out that I'm her daughter. So there's some concern about that. And my sister, she a few years back, like probably about 10 years ago, said something like, I don't think we can associate because we have different values.
So you're pretty much then cut off from your extended family.
Actually, my sister's the one that cut me out. My mom cried for a year and then worked her way through it, and my mom and I are still best friends, and we talk a couple times a week.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, so mom still worries. And so when I publish something or I do a TV show, she's always going, you didn't use, you know, your family's last name, did you? Because, you know, like most sex workers, I have a chosen name, which is different than my birth name.
Mm-hmm.
And so my mother's very concerned that I don't use my birth name because she doesn't want to, you know, deal with the scandal at church. So let's get to
the publishing aspect of you. You have a recent book out. What is the title of it?
Sex Secrets of Escorts. Veronica Monet's Sex Secrets of Escorts, Tips from a Pro, and it's from Alpha Books, which is a division of Penguin Books. It came out September of 2005, so it's been out for 2 years. And I'm working on a new book. I am. Yeah, and it's also got an interesting title. I like interesting titles that are thought-provoking or sound really banal. So I would say most of my book titles are pretty banal. This one's going to be The Straight Man's Guide to Getting Laid.
Wow. That's pretty straightforward. If somebody wants to get all of your books, all of the material, where should they go? What's the best way to get this?
The easiest thing to do is just go to Amazon and type in Veronica Monet.
Oh, wonderful.
Amazon.com is also carrying one of my serial shorts called White Trash Confessions.
And do you have an email address that you would like to give out for people to write to you?
Absolutely. And they should check out the website sexwithoutshame.com. So, if you want to send me an email,
what's your email address?
Email is veronica@sexwithoutshame.com.
Okay, wonderful. And now I want to get into some of the material itself. You have a one particular line of material that I did not quite understand, so I'm going to have you explain it. Quote,
okay.
I am committed to paving a path to peace by facilitating the healing of sexual shame. What path to peace are you talking about?
I know, this is just completely outside of the cultural paradigm. Okay, so I have to talk a little bit about natural sciences to make this connection, so bear with me.
Start right at the beginning, wherever you want, Veronica.
There's this animal out there that shares about 99% of our DNA. And this creature lives in the Congo, and it does not have any rape, murder, or war. Now, a lot of people would think so. What animals do? Well, our other nearest living relative, the chimpanzee, has got infanticide, rape, murder, and war. And chimpanzees, you know, Jane Goodall went to live with them for 6 years. She was convinced the chimpanzees were peaceful. She lived with them for a few years, and then they declared a war with a neighboring tribe of chimpanzees, which lasted for a whole 4 years. And the females in the chimpanzee social structure suffer a great deal. They live some pretty desperate lives. They have to live in periphery to the tribe because if they're not careful, males will bash the heads of their babies in or tear them from limb to limb because they practice infanticide, which means you kill the babies that aren't yours. And this other creature that doesn't do this is called the bonobo, and the bonobo has every kind of sex you could possibly imagine. It practices lesbian sex, gay sex, heterosexual sex, procreative sex, non-procreative sex. They have orgies. They even have prostitution. But for all of the sex that this particular species is having, it does not have any infanticide, meaning it does not kill its babies. It doesn't have any rape. There is no such thing as non-consensual sex with the bonobo. It has no war, and it has no murder. So I think that's incredibly interesting that we've got one of our closest living relatives on this planet has found a solution to violence by turning to sex instead.
Well, that's not an unheard of solution. And in fact, in many of the pagan societies, going back all the way back through the original priestess and so on and so forth, back in Great Britain, the Celtic societies, there was often sex was often used in the temples to quell the anger of men, and sex was freely available for that very purpose.
Yeah, well, and if you're not worried about who the father is, sex becomes a lot less angry and a lot more peaceful. I mean, it's all of this urge to figure out who's going to father the children. So the bonobos have solved that by evolving incredibly enormous testicles, and so they compete for the genetic lottery with a lot of sperm. And then they don't worry about who's having sex with who. Everybody has sex with everybody, and there's no fighting. Now, I don't know if some of your listeners may have read the Smithsonian this year. The Smithsonian had a big article about the bonobos, and this journalist went into the Congo to try to prove that the bonobos aren't really that matrifocal and they aren't really that peaceful. And I thought it was kind of interesting because, you know, a lot of people are trying to assert that the bonobos are matriarchal. Now, that really means that you've got a female who's at the helm, just like you would have in a patriarchy. You got one male in charge. And that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about something that's a little more like the indigenous cultures of some tribes. Iroquois Indians are a very good example. They always had a male chief, but they had the grandmother who could veto the male chief's decisions. A lot more decision-making sharing going on. And there's checks and balances, you know, just like we've been trying to do with this country. Not too well lately, but...
we're not doing well at all, Veronica.
We're not.
The matriarchal society is very ancient. Where it crossed over to the patriarch, I have no idea. But it became
a lot more sex positive. It's usually a lot more sex positive and a lot more peaceful.
Well, you know, I guess that's why many of us are trying to recreate society at some level, and obviously the patriarchal system has not worked very well. We note that simply by at the age of 64, I was born in 1943, and I've lived in a constant state of war since 1943. You know, something's wrong with this picture.
Yeah.
So, okay, let's get back to the path to peace and facilitating the healing of sexual shame. What are we talking about when we talk about sexual shame?
A lot of times when I try to help people, I try to help people by sharing my experience. You know, what have I been through that I can pass on to people? And when I became a sex worker, I encountered a lot of sexual shame, and some of the stuff that came up for me was that I had a really hostile attitude towards men. I was verging on lesbian separatism, which meant I really didn't want anything to do with men at all. I might, you know, have sex with them for an hour just so I could take their money, but then they could just get out of my face. And very interesting thing about working with men's bodies, I started end up working with their emotions, I started working with their souls, and you know, it became very, very difficult to ignore this very vulnerable person who's naked not only physically but emotionally, oftentimes you know, maybe crying in my arms, because an interesting thing happens around sex. People release other emotions. And I gradually became more and more compassionate, and I realized that one of the things that was in operation here was that I was ashamed of my own sexuality. I was ashamed of my own body for being female, just, you know, for the fact that I squat to pee even. I felt like this culture had made me feel ashamed for having female genitalia, and certainly ashamed if I had any sexual desire as a female. So when I was able to work past that, I didn't have any reason to hate men anymore because they were no longer the enemy. And it opened up a whole world where I, you know, once I freed myself from being ashamed of my own sexuality, I could love other people a lot. And I could love them regardless of what kind of genitalia they had. So I thought that was a really worthwhile journey that I wanted to share with people about the idea that a lot of times, you know, our anger, our resentment, our hatred, our suspicion, it comes from an inability to accept ourselves. And if we can work past our, you know, the training that a lot of us have got, you know, I certainly was trained not to accept myself and not love myself. And if I could get to the point where I could do those things, then it was a lot easier to be loving and accepting of other people. And for women, I encounter this all the time when I teach my workshops and I'm working with women, just a basic, on a cellular level, shame about having a vagina. It's so sad, and it's so prevalent. So I really, you know, I'm working to share that with women, that your bodies are beautiful regardless of what shape they come in, but even just beyond that, that, you know, the vagina is a beautiful, sacred source of life, and we need to start, you know, maybe going back to some of the opinions that we used to have about women's genitalia, which was that it was gorgeous and beautiful and certainly not anything to be ashamed or apologetic about.
Well, there is a male side to this also, Veronica, and a lot of confusion over centuries between religion and politics and people who claim to have answers about sexuality. There's a lot of confusion that has gone on. There is a male side to this also.
When you talk to
people about sexuality, first of all, if you're in the general public arena, everyone has a tendency to want to say the politically correct thing. And
yeah,
that's certainly not the case on my show. I could care less about politics. So what I'm about to say to you is not going to be politically correct. And when and actually, this is for the audience also. I'm going to give Veronica Monet Nevin's concept of male sexuality in 25 words or less. And folks, what it comes down to, in terms of my own opinion, I don't know if you're going to get this anywhere else. Male sexuality is a fairly, at the most basic level, it's a fairly simple process. The sac fills up, semen builds up, and it spills out. That's male sexuality at its most basic level. I don't care what kind of attitude the male has, it's going to spill out, whether it's through a sexual process with a partner, or whether it's masturbation, or whether it's a wet dream. That semen is going to flow. The flow of semen through the universe is constant, and there ain't no way a male is going to stop it. Now, the entire male sexuality hinges around the flow of that semen. What I'm saying is, if it don't flow, there's no orgasm. Nature found a beautiful way to ensure that the species survives, and that is that the orgasm is attached directly to the flow of that semen. That's basically male sexuality. However, the problem for men is that in modern culture, sexuality is no longer a party. In other words, as you were describing before, Veronica, where sex was free and open, men have now had to curtail their own sexuality to fit along the lines of the politically correct kinds of sex, marriage, dating, and so on and so forth, and all the ritual that goes around it.
And in fact, most males, under the general conditions,
they don't have emotional problems. All they're really trying to do is get rid of that semen, because after a while it just starts creating a lot of physical pressure, tension. Okay, now it's back to you, Veronica. You got my opinion about male sexuality.
All right, so Nevin, and before I tell you about my opinion about male sexuality, and bear with me, if you will, because it's a little bit long, just like yours was, but perhaps not as straight to the point as yours was. Just to let your listeners know, like, how do I qualify to have an opinion about male sexuality? Well, first and foremost, because I've been working with a lot of men over the course of 14 years. I was an escort for 14 years. During that time, I kept track of how many different sexual partners I had, and it was 1,869 men.
That's
so,
a lot.
Well, you know, a statistically significant sample is 30. So I'd say 1,869 surpasses that by quite a bit. Was it a random sample? Of course not, because it was specific to the type of person that I am. However, for those people who are interested, my demographics were pretty diverse. I had clients that were politically connected. I had clients who were famous. I had clients who were incredibly wealthy, as in worth billions of dollars. And I had clients who were just simple truck drivers. So the demographics were pretty diverse. A lot of different races, a lot of different countries, a lot of different ages, anything from 18 to 80, single, married, bisexual, transgender. I have really, really seen a lot. And this is what I walked away from. I walked away from that exposure to all of that diversity, that primarily sexuality for the human creature, whether it has a penis or a vagina, the human creature is motivated sexually more about status, more about membership. And we're very, very concerned about where we belong in the social structure. So I saw men spend enormous amounts of money for my time because they thought that that meant something for them socially. It meant that they had arrived or that they were that wealthy that they could afford it. The other thing that I saw was a lot of men who, when they were privately not around their friends, trying to show off with their friends and be the man, whatever that meant, actively choosing not to ejaculate, actively choosing not to even engage in sexual intercourse, actively choosing instead to pursue other avenues sexually. And this was a real shock to me. I really thought that my job as an escort was going to be really about release, you know, helping people to achieve an orgasm and get on their way. And it was so not about that that I was really shocked, and I ended up having to send myself back to school to learn all kinds of other ways of being sexual because this was the diversity that was coming to me. And I was impressed with how complex men are, that they weren't just simple ejaculating machines who were looking for something to get off. That in fact, they were looking for intellectual stimulation and spiritual connection. But the big one, no matter how you know, how deep thinking or how superficial the person was, the big one, the one that came up over and over again was, I want to feel connection. And this is my theory about, you know, do we have seed? You know what? Women also have prostate glands. There's the Skene's glands. They're located in the same area as the prostate in the male, and they produce ejaculate. And, yes, we all build a certain amount of pelvic tension when that fluid builds up. Men and women both do. But you can release that fluid at home by yourself without spending a dime, and you can usually do it a lot quicker and a lot more efficiently than you can with a partner. So partner sex is usually not so physiologically motivated as it is psychologically and emotionally motivated, and we want connection. We want to feel like we're valuable, like this other person sees some intrinsic worth in us. And a lot of our validation comes through sex, whether it's flirting or full-on intercourse, or the right to procreate and spread your genetic material. Still, most of that stuff is still really bound to our self-esteem.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So you hit it right on the head.
Literally. I really found that men were much more interested in what does this say about me as a person? Am I important? Am I attractive? Am I a success? Have I made it? Have I arrived? Those things were so much more important than just having an orgasm.
Well, Veronica, we're gonna run out of time here, and I want to touch on a few other things.
Go for it.
I really would like you to talk a little bit about Tantra and sacred sexual techniques. So why don't you tell our audience a little bit about Tantra?
Okay. Tantra is amazing. It's really changed my whole attitude about sex. I'm not even sure where sex begins and ends anymore because of Tantra. Because, like, I have friends who practice Tantra, and when we see each other, we give each other a what we call a heart chakra hug, meaning that we align our heart chakras and breathe into each other's heart chakras. And we'll do that just to say hello, and it feels very sexually charged. and we've got our clothes on. And I've done exercises, Tantra exercises with other colleagues, where you can actually achieve a sensation of being penetrated with your clothes on without even touching each other. You're just seated across from each other. And if you learn to play with the Kundalini energy, and breathing, conscious breathing techniques, you can achieve an orgasm. I did that taking a class from a woman named Jawala in Marin County years and years ago. It's called Fire Breath Orgasm. And you just lay on the floor, and you contract your PC muscles, and you breathe rhythmically through your nose and out your mouth. You do that about 20 minutes, you can have an amazing orgasm that starts at the base of your spine, and it blows out the top of your head, feels like a ball of fire. Never, ever touch your genitals. Never take your clothes off. Never have physical contact with another person. And here you can have this full-blown orgasm. So that's an amazing, amazing discovery to me. And that ties spirituality to your sexuality, where you're able to meditate, do conscious breathing. You can use prayer and ritual and achieve orgasm that has nothing to do with the genitals. So,
well, I want to stop you for a second. You're raising there are a few things that I'm thinking about as you're talking about it in terms of this extra sensation. And I have yet to try this, but Jill and I talked about it. And I'm a little hesitant. I'm afraid of choking. This is a lot simpler than what you're talking about. I was going to try putting a Dove chocolate in my mouth just prior to the point of orgasm, but I was afraid of choking. And so this was Jill, just kind of a little side trip that we were taking when we were talking about sex one day. And I thought, gee, you know, I kind of like to try that.
How about you... instead of putting a chunk of chocolate in there, because it could possibly choke you, what if instead you had a dropper or something that you could suck on that just happened to have chocolate in it so that you wouldn't actually have the chance of swallowing it?
Oh, that's a good idea. Something you're talking about, already having something melted maybe. Yeah, that would.
Yeah.
I didn't think of that.
Yeah, something that you could suck on even, you know, right at that moment. I could tell you, your list, like some of the stuff that I do, I actually visualize. I think that orgasms are incredibly powerful. You think about they have the capacity to create life. I think you can use the energy around orgasm to create a lot of things. And I actually use a lot of creative visualization and affirmations for the things that I want to pull into my life. And I will do that right at the moment of orgasm, actually be visualizing beautiful, wonderful things that I want to bring into my life as I have an orgasm.
Okay, before we run out of time, I want to get to letter to wives, you know, the letter from the other woman.
Yes.
It's all about the truth about men. And spend a few minutes and tell us about the truth about men.
Well, you know, men and women grow up in different cultures. I personally, you know, we've had this argument for years and years, and we'll probably continue to have it. Like, just kind of like we can't figure out whether the chicken came before the egg or the egg came before the chicken. A lot of times we've got a lot of disagreement about how much of our behavior is driven by hormones and how much of it is, you know, driven by training. So it's that old nature-nurture argument that we could go on, and it's probably always going to be a combination of the two. I tend to be a little more interested in what we can create through nurture, so I'm interested in how our training and our culture shapes us. But, you know, I've been pregnant, and I understand hormones have a huge impact on our behavior, too. But I really like to encourage men and women to think of each other as not creatures from Mars and Venus, but rather creatures from the same planet Earth, who have far more in common than we'll ever have as far as differences go. So if we can think about each other as coming from different countries, different cultures, if you traveled to India and you fell in love with somebody in India, you would never, ever be so stupid as to say, well, I can't learn your language and I can't learn to like your food and I'll never listen to your music because you're from India and I'm from the United States. Instead, you'd go to great lengths to learn this other person's culture. As an escort, I had to learn the male culture. I never thought to myself, oh, they're a foreign creature from another planet, so I can't figure out what this smells like. I was like, it's just a different culture. For God's sake, take the trouble to learn it.
Take the trouble to learn. And that's what people fail to do on both sides of the equation, Veronica. I run into a lot of men who do not bother to understand the culture of the female any more than females want to take the time to understand the culture of men.
You know what happens when you travel? When you go to another country and you learn another person's culture, you become a bigger person. So I think it's interesting and exciting to learn about male culture, learn about female culture, and expand your world. And then
Veronica, we are out of time.
It's been fascinating.
I can't believe how fast this goes by for me every week. I want to thank you for coming on our show today.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
And it's been great. You've got the last word. What do you want to say to the audience?
Hey, if you want to read more, go to veronicamonet.com. If you want to know what it is I can do for you, and if there's anything I can do to help you, go to sexwithoutshame.com. Give me a call toll-free. My number is 888-903-0050. I'm here basically Monday through Friday, 10 to 10, and if I'm traveling or doing a workshop, you'll get my voicemail, but I will call you back.
Thank you so much, Veronica, and have a wonderful evening. Good night.
Take care. Thanks, Nevin. Bye-bye.
Well, folks, it was another fascinating journey on Woodland Star. I really wished for this particular interview that I had more time, but I don't. And there's a lot to learn in this world. That's just one part of it. Thank you for listening, and I wish all of you a wonderful day. That's a wrap, Don.